history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty amazing stories waiting to be heard. All it takes is time, a little curiosity, and the willingness to listen. We want our veterans to know we appreciate their service and sacrifice, and that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we listen to their stories, we're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up gleaning some inspiration as well. We're going to meet a pair of 93-year-olds today. They live on opposite sides of the country, and though they both served in the Army Air Corps in World War II, they had very, very different experiences. One was shot down in the skies over Europe. The other never saw combat. They both have reason to believe they've been living on borrowed time for quite a while, and they've both found ways to make their time count. We're going to start with Roy Cotner of Sanger, California, also known as the nation's Christmas tree city because of the famed General Grant tree in the nearby Sequoia National Forest. And trees will have a lot to do with what we hear about Roy's story.
We're sitting right next to an orange grove. I think I saw a sheep out there. This is country living, and you've been living that life for a long, long time, haven't you, Roy?
I've been here about getting close to 90 years now.
What do you remember about your childhood out here?
I grew up down here at the corner of Belmont and Trimmer Springs Road, that big two-story house there. That belonged to George Hume. Hume Lake, he's one to put
The lumber flume?
The flume all the way down. It went right down. This is Flume Road here.
Where we're sitting is right next to the famed lumber flume that brought logs down from the mountains here all the way to the valley floor. And George Hume, who you just mentioned, is the namesake of Hume Lake, which is very popular now that the Christian camp there draws thousands every year. So you knew Mr. Hume.
I knew him. We would go, Jack Bratton lived in he was the foreman. He lived in the big house. We lived on the corner of View and Belmont, but my dad had bought both sides of Hume's place, and he wanted that place real bad because it had a nice house on it, and our little old shack wasn't much over there. So he asked the foreman repeatedly if George would sell him that 10 acres of lemons and the house. Well, of course, he didn't want to sell it because he'd have to move somewhere else. Well, my dad finally got tired, and he called Mr. Hume up. He knew him. He lived in Detroit. They had lumber business back there, I suppose. And he said, yes, I'll sell it. So the next time he came out, well, my dad and him agreed on the price. He paid $10,000 for that 10 acres and the house. And that put Jack Bratton out of a job. So they were all Masons. My dad wasn't. But at their meeting at Sanger, they called Mr. Bratton up, and George Hume gave him a little talk and gave him $10,000 for his time of service. That's what my dad paid for the ranch. And that's how we got all this 70-some acres in a line here.
And this is acreage that you are still working on. You're 93 years old, but you still get out there in the tractor, and what do you do?
Oh, yeah, I check water. I got a golf cart. You know, we have mister system now in the orchard, so we drive every other row, and you can look both sides and see that both of them and misters are working. If something's wrong when they're plugged up, you got to get off and fix them.
But, well, a lot of guys, when they're your age, they say, I'm going to let somebody else do that. Why is it important to you to continue being involved that way?
Well, I like to see them get ahead here, so I'm helping them out. I don't get paid or anything.
Yeah.
Well, I do. I get a share.
Well, and your impact on the tree fruit industry is pretty interesting, too, and we're going to talk about that before we're done. But I'm interested in your childhood. You're out here on the ranch. Were you guys working from a real young age? Did you have a whole bunch of chores to do with this acreage?
When we were kids, the Chinese had the ranch before, and they let it go. There was Bermuda grass all around the trees. Well, my brother and I, it was our job. When we got home from school, we had to go out and dig out the Bermuda around most of the trees, you know, as we every day almost.
And that's not easy because those things, those tentacles go everywhere at Bermuda.
They sure do.
Did you do it by hand or did you have a tool?
Well, we had a hole.
Yeah.
We didn't spray in those days but now you could spray it with diesel or weed oil or such a thing like that.
For a kid, that has to seem like an unending job to get all that Bermuda out of an orchard.
Yeah.
Yikes. But that's what you had to do.
That's what we had to do. Anyway, I went to Centerville School and Sanger High School. And I graduated in 1941, so my future was ahead of me because the war broke out. We go back a little further. I was in the eighth grade, I had a little .22 rifle.
Uh-huh.
It was automatic and just a little short thing. And all those kids would run around. We all had .22s. We'd go shoot at my cousin's place, shoot into the lumber wood pile and everything. Everyone still burnt wood for heat and everything like that. And so my aunt called us in for lunch. It was like on a Saturday, I guess. And so we all go inside and I take my little rifle and I set it down and lean it on me. And my little four-year-old cousin, he waddles over there and he pulls the trigger on my rifle. I left a bullet in there, and I got shot in my stomach here, right below the navel. It made an arc and just missed my heart, and it was still into the skin right here, the bullet. John Molia, he lived on the ranch where my cousins were living, and he hauled me to the Sanger Hospital in his Model A coupe. That night, I had an operation, and my dad, after the operation, he went down to the pool hall to have a beer, I guess. And who do you think was in there? The assistant doctor. And he was telling the group of people there that that boy got shot in the stomach. He didn't have a chance. But I made it through it. So.
Wow.
So anyway, to get back to the Army, when I got to Macon, Georgia from San Antonio after basic, they made an outfit. We were going to be in the 8th Air Force. We got a call to go to Florida, at the lower part of Florida. But they used to send busloads down. And I was the last one left. So I had to do the morning report and everything. After about 3 days, I never got any call to go or anything. So I went to the commanding officer and I find out what the problem was. Well, he says, let me get your records. So he got my records and looked at it. Well, he says, you got you down here as 4F. I says, 4F? And I knew what they were talking about. So I says, well, I played football 3 years in high school. I've worked for a year for the government. And I'm still 4F. Well, he says, strip your clothes down and let me check you out. So I just took my clothes off and he checked me out. He pushed around on me here and there. Well, you've been that long, so I'll take you off 4F. So I got to join the group down in the lower part of Florida. And our job was putting in cannons and B-25s to send to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And about half of our group had to go there, but I never did have to go. After that, I went to northern Florida at Avon Park. That was a B-17 training base. We had a lot of work because these guys wouldn't land just right, and my wing tips were real bad. So,
well, I want to ask you some questions about that.
Sure.
But first on the 4F thing. So for, you know, maybe some of the younger people listening, they don't understand what 4F means. Basically, it means you're physically disqualified from serving.
Yeah.
And it was because of the bullet wound from when you're an eighth grader?
Yeah.
When your cousin accidentally shot you in the stomach?
Yeah.
You had been classified 4F, but you weren't aware of that.
I wasn't aware of it.
So after you finished high school, you went and took a class, a month-long class, to learn how to fix airplane engines?
Yeah, no, metalwork, wings, whatever.
Uh-huh. And because of that class, you got a job in Sacramento at the Air Depot.
That's right. McClellan Air Base was right next to it. Our job was, or the job I had anyway, was putting bulletproof fuel tanks in the wings.
Mm-hmm.
They were made where you could unscrew the top part and you'd drop them in and you'd have to test them and see that there was no leaks or anything like that. I was good at doing forming of aluminum, making the leading edges on the wings and stuff like that. When I got drafted, my foreman gave me a letter of recommendation to go into the Air Force.
Yeah, so you'd already been part of the war effort, working as a civilian on those planes in Sacramento, but now you're drafted into the service. You mentioned that confusion about whether or not you were 4F because of the childhood injury, but now you end up in Florida reconfiguring B-25s by adding cannons in the nose to prepare them for North Africa?
I had to reinforce the structure of the plane to hold the cannons.
Mm.
But the pilot said that when they fired those cans off, the airplane would just kind of shudder a little bit, you know.
I bet.
They were for shooting the tanks over there. From there, I went up to Avon Park, and I finished the year out at a B-17 training base, repairing them.
Uh-huh.
Two of them, it was pretty bad, but were fixable. We took two and made one out of it.
Sure, yeah. So cannibalized one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
You get that beat-up plane, and you have to make it airworthy again. How does that work? What do you do?
Well, we usually just start tearing parts off and taking the other ones and put on. Really nothing to it.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a little common sense. That's the same thing I did when I went overseas. I lucked out. I went to 13th Replacement Depot. I got assigned right there, Wheeler Field, right next to Schofield.
That's on the island of Oahu, of course, and Wheeler Field is one of the American installations that was hit by the Japanese on December 7th, 1941. And I bet you saw some pretty fresh evidence of that when you got there in late 1943.
Our buildings were just loaded with or the 50 caliber shells that hit the bank, and they never tried to repair them.
You can still find those bullet holes there today.
Did they leave them in those buildings? I thought I wanted to kind of go there and look around.
Of all the planes that you worked on, did you have a favorite?
My favorite actually was B-25 because we had one ourselves there. Our headquarters was in Hilo on the other island. And every Saturday, our commanding officer wanted to get his flight pay, so he would go there. Well, once in a while, I'd get the crewie's plane, or I'd ride with a crew boss. And the funny part was, one day, we were ready to go, and already had the engines going. We got some extra gas that wanted to go. So we had to send for more parachutes. So they called down, and here he comes with a tug with a three or four more parachutes. And I'm at the bay window catching them as they throw them up. The last damn parachute, somehow or other, I grabbed it in the wrong place, and I popped that ripcord in my parachute, pops open, and the colonel comes back, and he says, Cotner, he says, I don't mind the parachute, but he says, gas is hard to get.
So you were on Oahu when Japan surrendered.
Right. I got to march in the Victory in Europe parade on Honolulu and also at the Japanese surrender. After the war was over, a fleet of B-24s, we had to recondition them. There must have been 20 or so. If they needed new engines, they got new engines. And we repaired any metalwork that had to be done. And who do you think got them? Chinese got them. And the funny part is, they wanted someone to fly with them all the time when they're... I was designated to do that, so I'd ride with all these Chinese, and what they do, they saw a fishing boat, they would dive on that boat, and hell, they wouldn't miss it 100 feet, check it out, supposedly. And that's I don't know whether they went to Taiwan or whether they went to China with them.
Yeah, so these are B-24s that yeah. We're done with because World War II is over.
Yeah.
But Chiang Kai-shek is still going at it and can use some B-24s.
Yeah.
And you were the guy that had to go up with them and make sure everything was working.
That's right.
What does it feel like to dive on a fishing boat and come within 100 feet?
Well, first time, I wondered what the hell was going on.
So you never experienced combat, but you had in your own way contributed to the Allied victory in World War II. You came home to California. You met your wife, Eva. Your brother, Floyd, who had served in the Army in Europe during the war, was back home too. And you two brothers went to work farming this land you grew up on. But Mother Nature didn't really cooperate.
Oh, it was tough. We had citrus, 20 acres of lemons, froze 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And so my brother says, shall we pull them out? So we pulled all those lemons out and planted oranges. What do you know? It come and killed the little orange trees the next year. 3 years in a row in the late 40s, we had cold weather. Never had cold weather for a long time after that. But it was just a cycle that we went against us, and that's how come I became a barber for 20-some years.
Yeah, so there's probably a few folks listening right now who got a haircut or two from you, and I know there are a whole lot of tree fruit growers who bought more than a few of your innovative tree props. Some folks might not know what we're talking about, so can you explain that to us? What is a tree prop?
Well, a tree prop is like 1 by 2 by 10 or 12 feet. And it just goes underneath the limbs of the peaches or plums or whatever to hold the limbs up when they get heavy with the fruit. When the season's over, you gather them up and save them for another year.
Forever, people have been propping up limbs, but they'll just find, you know, I got an 8 foot piece of 1 by 2, I'll stick that in there. Oh no, I need 10 feet for this. There's no adjustable nature to this tree prop, right? It's just a piece of wood. So you thought, what if we could make them adjustable?
We made a metal hook that would slide over it. with gouges on it. And when the pressure come on the limb, it would make it tight. It wouldn't slide up down the... They made them already, but nobody had a good one. So we developed this good one.
What made you think you could make it better?
You put the hook on there, maybe sometimes they wouldn't catch on and slide, then the limb would break or something other like that. I had all the big farmers in the country and the little ones too.
Does that seem like a big deal to you, what you did with those props and the amount of fruit you probably saved by producing those?
Well, I guess it was, actually.
That's what I'm thinking about. Tell me if I'm wrong, but isn't the implication here that by designing and marketing a better tree prop, you saved a ton of fruit, not just to put money in the farmers' pockets who are growing it, but to feed people? There's a lot of plums and pluots and apricots and peaches and nectarines that got eaten that would have gone to waste.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're probably talking millions, right?
Oh, yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
Over decades.
Yeah.
And pretty much every farmer listening right now on the radio has used one of your tree props.
Well, that's right. And also, we used to raise citrus nursery, too.
Mm-hmm.
We got orange trees all over around there.
You have had quite an impact, and you're still going strong at 93. I know you recently went to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. And I'm sure you heard these two words a few times on that journey, but I want to say them, too. Thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thanks for your time today. And I do have one more question. As a member of what's been called the greatest generation, what does America represent to you? For those of us who are younger, and you do have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, what do we all need to understand about America?
Well, here, if you work, you can get ahead. If you don't work, you're not getting ahead. My theory is you better pick out something you'd like to do and do that. If you like it, you'll make it.
Good advice from Roy Kottner, 93 years young. You'll find photos of Roy in action at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And you're also going to find links to the ongoing effort by a World War II prisoner of war who's making a difference in the lives of today's returning veterans. We're going to hear about that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an update. I'm excited to share about a veteran who appeared on this program way back in 2009. Hometown Heroes was only on one station then, not all the places it can be heard now. And Erwin Stoveroff was just getting started with what has become the most satisfying pursuit of his life, providing service dogs for veterans returning from our current wars around the world. I'm going to share some of the latest figures in a little bit, but as you listen to this ex-prisoner of war share his incredible journey, why don't you also go over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and find links to his organization, Vets Helping Heroes, and also a link to Lisa Weiser's book about Erwin Stoveroff called An Extraordinary Life Gone to the Dogs. Now let's hear it in his own words, Erwin Stoveroff of Boca Raton, Florida, on how he became involved in helping other veterans, first as a service officer at his local VA, then through this incredible organization, Vets Helping Heroes.
I retired and decided that there was more to life than just playing golf, or I enjoyed tennis and I found time for that, but I think it was more important that I do something for veterans and particularly ex-POWs who were not as lucky as I am and coming home and at this stage of life, feeling very, very good. I'm very fortunate. So That's what I decided to do. And at a director's meeting at the hospital in Palm Beach, I was advised of something that absolutely floored me. It was the fact that our government does not supply any funds or anything to help any of these young men who are blind and disabled. Yes, they do a complete rehab program for them, but when they're finished with their rehab program, they have to rely on private donors to get them a seeing eye or a service dog. When I found that out, I just said, I've got to do something. And they advised me at the VA, would I be interested in starting an organization and tying in with America's Vet Dogs canine program from Smithtown, New York? I said, yes, I would. I got involved through the VA with the American Vet Dog canine program and told them what I had in mind was to raise funds, and they were very anxious for me to get started. Very, very cooperative, and they are to today. I mean, we have a great relationship. They're a wonderful organization, and so I'm pleased that the funds I'm raising are for them. Something had to be done beyond what even they were doing, because these vets were waiting a long time.
I'm sure that one of the most rewarding things for you is to see what these dogs actually mean to the veterans when they get back. What's kind of the biggest thing that you've seen, or the most moving thing you've seen, as far as how much of an impact having that service dog has on a veteran coming home?
You know, the first dog that we got was for a young man who lost both his arms. His name is Eddie Wright. I got to meet Eddie and got to know him. And it's a good question, because I asked the same thing. I said, Eddie, what is the most important thing this dog has meant for you since you got him? And he said, the most important thing is when I'm walking down the street, people look at my dog, they don't look at me. And I thought, oh my gosh, I never thought of that. Mm. But how important it is to these young men, because, you know, they are handicapped, they are disabled, they have lost part of their limbs, or they've lost their eyes or their brains. And what a great remark that was, that, you know, people aren't staring at me anymore. That's just one example of what I've seen. I've been to Walter Reed several times in Washington, and I see these young men as they're learning and just starting with new legs or new arms. You got to start crying when you see this. It's so emotional. But when you talk to them and when you make them understand that you have an opportunity to give them something that they will have that is so important for them, for example, mobility, independence, and companionship, and an undying love. I talked to a young man by the name of Aaron down here in Palm Beach, and he was blind. He had been on three tours before they finally got him. He was unsure that he knew that his wife and children were there waiting for him, and his mother would take care of him. And I had my dog. I have a dog that was reassigned to me. His name is Cash. And I had Cash with me at the hospital, and I had him pet him and listen to him, and I explained to him what that dog had meant to me. And I said to him, "Is one of the reasons why I'm doing this is I went through combat, but gosh, I'm lucky. You know, I came back in one piece. I didn't lose my eyes, my arms, my legs, nothing. I just had an experience. But here you are, and you've been through this, and what I'd like to do for you and what we want to do, not me, the Vet Dogs Canine Corps and my organization, Vets Helping Heroes, we want you to have, at no cost to you, a gift for life." And let me explain when I say a gift for life, because a dog, a service, professionally trained service dog, will work 24 hours a day for, let us say, 8 to 9, maybe 10 years at the most. Mm-hmm. And after that dog is going to be retired. And we will automatically, when the dog is retired, we will replace that dog with another dog for our heroes. I call them our heroes. And that's why we call this program A Gift for Life.
Well, and again, the organization is Vets Helping Heroes. It's at vetshelpingheroes.org. We're talking to Erwin Stoveroff, the president of that organization. I'm sure, listening to his voice, you won't believe what his actual age is, but you can tell that this fulfilling work is keeping him young. He has a pretty interesting story to tell as well. And with all the prisoners of war, the ex-prisoners of war that you've heard on this show, you've probably heard it said time and time again that their motto for the American ex-prisoners of war, we help those who cannot help themselves. That's what Erwin Stoveroff is doing now. But I want to find out a little bit, Erwin, and we will come back to your organization and how people listening today can help. I want to hear a little bit about your story during World War II. I've gotten some tidbits, and it's pretty remarkable. But let's start at the beginning. How did you end up as a bombardier in the U.S. Army Air Corps?
Well, number one, I volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, I wanted to fly. And number three, I guess I was as patriotic as every other guy that enlisted. It's something, I have to say it, our generation believed in it. I mean, there was no hesitation whatsoever. Even with a draft, there was no hesitation for wanting to be a part of it. You had to be. So that's how I got involved. But I knew I wanted to be in, and it was then called the Air Corps, which is now the Air Force. I went through my all exams and everything that was required, and I was all set to do my basic training in pilots. And they advised us, I'll never forget, I was down in San Antonio, Texas, at Kelly Field, and they said, gentlemen, we have pilots. We've got a real problem. We have a shortage of bombardiers and navigators. That's what we're looking for, and that's what we'll hope that you will volunteer to do. And later on, if you want to become a pilot, we'll see about it. But right now, we don't have them, and we need them. So I became a bombardier.
The B-17 Bombardier serving with the 44th Bomb Group. But you were in at a time where they'd gone past 25 missions would get you home. It was going to take 35 missions to get you back to the States. So I imagine when you took off with your crew for that 35th mission, there was probably a little bit of excitement or extra adrenaline in the airplane that day.
Oh, well, first place we started off, you're right, at 25, and then they raised it to 30. And then after 30... they said, you know, we'll never fly more than 35. And they were certainly right in my case. They said, because, you know, if we do get the crews in, we were still losing a lot of crews, you know. You will not have to go to the 35th mission. Well, we did. The 35th mission, which was our last, really and truly was our last, because I got shot down. We were just over the channel on a short run. I could see the English Channel right out of my window. And we started our bomb run, and we were going to bomb and blowing up all the bridges to keep the Germans from escaping back into Germany. That was our target that day in the Falle Gap, and it was near the city of Caen. What happened is there was several bursts of flak, and we got hit on our number one and number two engine, and the hydraulic system failed. Everything was failing. There was fire coming into the ship, so we had to bail out. I was in the nose of the plane, so I jumped through the nose wheel door. And fortunately, every one of us got out of the plane before it exploded.
Now, I've read a little bit of you telling this story, and you say the first thing that you did after you exited that airplane, well, obviously you had to pull your chute, but you threw something toward the ground. Tell us what that was and why you did that.
I got rid of my dog tags because I'm Jewish, and it had H on there. And, you know, in those days, I don't know what they're doing now, but you had to have an HC or a P on your dog tag. So knowing where I was going, I decided the best thing I could do was get rid of my dog tags because they were shooting at me as I was coming down, so there was no way they would say I was a spy that they had picked up in the country. And I did land right in the German front lines, and I was captured. Well, they were shooting at me coming down. I was captured immediately and taken to a cemetery and... I looked around, and the German officer said, 9-9, we do not kill our prisoners.
Which I'm sure made you feel everything was just fine.
Oh, yeah. It was a great feeling knowing they don't kill their prisoners. But, you know, they kept us in a farmyard for a while. My co-pilot and I tried to escape. We got caught and told us if we'd ever did it again that they would kill us. They would shoot us for trying to escape, which we were told we were supposed to do, so we tried it one time, and that was that. After several days in the field, because we couldn't move because our P-51s and P-38s were shooting up everything on the ground, they finally loaded us in trucks at night, and we ended up in Paris for a few days, and from Paris I was taken to a Dulag Luft outside of Frankfurt, Germany, where all the air guy, all anybody in the Air Force was taken there for interrogation.
And this place is infamous for the interrogations that took place there, and really in some cases what some people would call torture. I mean, these prisoners were not necessarily treated pristinely there at Dulag Luft.
All I heard was the scare tactics. You'd hear the noise and the beating and all this stuff, and you'd think, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And after my original capture and what I went through in the beginning, I was not, anything happened to me except an unbelievable story while I was there. And may I tell the story?
Oh, I want to hear it. I know a little bit, but I want to hear all of it. And I think it has to do with the German officer interrogating you, right?
That is correct. I was in solitaire like the rest of us, but and you were taken in and out and taken in and out. And my third or fourth time.
Now, before you get to that, did that shake you at all? When they have you in solitary, you're in a room where you can barely scratch your back, let alone think. Did it get to you at all?
Yeah, I wasn't very happy, I can assure you. I was. I have to tell you, I think everybody else was. I think we were scared. I mean, we didn't know what to do, in particular being Jewish. You can't get that off your mind when you're in Hitler's territory. And actually what happened was that I think after my fourth interrogation, where it was name, rank, and serial number, because actually we didn't know much more than that, the officer opened up in perfect English and said to me, Lieutenant, you know, I know who you are, and I know what you are. And when he said that, I said, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
And that meant that he knew you were Jewish.
That's right. So he started off by naming my mother, father, brother, sister, the grammar school I went to, the high school I went to, actually named a young lady that I had taken out when I was dating before the war. And I just sat there and I said, I just don't understand. I don't understand. And then he said to me, well, let me explain something to you. You lived on Claremont Avenue in Buffalo, New York. And my parents lived on Ashland Avenue in Buffalo, New York, and you were my parents' newspaper boy.
Holy moly.
And I said, that's about the same thing. I just couldn't believe it. And he said to me, I came here for a reason. I came to be with my grandparents because we are going to win the war. And that was his answer to me. But he said, I will help you. And what he did do, under religion, on my papers that I found and I still have, he put a question mark under religion. And so I was moved on and put in the boxcars and moved on to my permanent camp in Barth, Germany.
Now, I do have one question about that. My understanding, and I've seen several POWs show me those papers that you're talking about. You have an image of yours online. It was your file from Dulag Luft when you were interrogated. It has your mugshot and all that and all this information. Now, were you sure at the time that he wrote that question mark in there, or
no.
Did you not find that out until after you were liberated?
After we got liberated, we went into the offices there, and they said, somebody said they found our files, and we all went and we all got our files, and I got mine, and down below, it has a great big J-U-D-E when they segregated me in my prison camp.
Mm-hmm. They took you to your prison camp, which was Stalag Luft 1. We've actually had several veterans on this show that were in that same POW camp in Barth on the Baltic. Sounds like a luxurious resort, but I don't think that's what it was for you. And I imagine traveling there on a 40 and 8 wasn't exactly a thrill ride either.
No, and you know what they did is, and I'm sure you've heard it before, what they did, they locked us in. They did not mark the top of these boxcars. At POW, which they were supposed to, they would leave us in the marshalling yards at night because the British were bombing marshalling yards. And the Americans were shooting up everything during the day. So, you know, there were guys, I am, again, very fortunate. It did not happen to me. But there were guys that I knew that were caught in these boxcars, and some kids got killed. Some of them were hurt because of the fire from the British or the Americans, particularly the fighter pilots coming down, shooting up all the trains. But fortunately, it did not happen to me, and I did arrive in one piece at beautiful Barth on the Baltic.
What's going through your mind as you get to this prisoner of war camp? Obviously, you have guys around you who are going through the same thing, and I'm sure that helps, but to me, the uncertainty of it seems like it might be a little overwhelming.
There was, you know, you're right, the uncertainty, but there was a you had a sense of at least I made it to a prison camp, you know, because if the civilians got you, they would kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the I was fortunate. I dropped out in France, but in Germany, a lot of the guys dropped there, and they were pitchforked. They were hung. The German civilians were after them, and the Luftwaffe would try to get you, at least get you to a prison camp. And it was a relief to walk into the camp, and there you are. There's already 1,000 guys or more in the camp. It's a sense of relief, but a sense of uncertainty. And uncertainty later on in February when I got segregated.
And we're going to hear about that, but it's time for another break. Don't forget to check out all the additional information on Erwin Stovaroff, his adventures in World War II, and his ongoing mission to support today's returning veterans. Lots of links for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with the story of Erwin Stovaroff. He's about to turn 94, but he has not slowed down a bit since I first interviewed him in 2009. In fact, he's only ramped up his efforts to provide today's returning veterans with service dogs. More on that in a bit, but now, back to Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany. He survived being shot down in August of 1944, but I imagine the further you got into 1945, the more difficult the conditions became.
We were one of the lucky camps that was getting Red Cross parcels, because if we relied on the Germans, the bread had nothing but sticks in it, and the soup was terrible, and kohlrabis and lousy, lousy potatoes is what they gave us.
So you weren't a fan of tree flour?
Not really. Not really at all, but the Red Cross, I would like to say regularly, and the truth is they regularly did get the boxes to us, but the Germans kept them from us because they just did. We found out after the war was over in the warehouse there were stacks of Red Cross boxes that they had kept from us, and I don't know how many they kept for themselves because, you know, we had Spam in there, we had cigarettes in there, we had Klim, which is milk spelt backwards, powdered milk.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that. And as a matter of fact, I remember an awful lot when you think about it. But, you know, there was enough there to sustain us. But without that, we all started to lose weight. And we did lose weight. And we did have sicknesses. They only did what they had to do with. Would I say they were an enemy that had full respect? Not particularly.
By early 1945, word started making its way around the camp that the Jewish prisoners would be separated out. And I can't imagine, Erwin, that the first time you heard that, it was anything close to good news.
I really and truly couldn't believe it. My co-pilot's brother was an adjutant to Colonel Gabreski in one of the other compounds. And, of course, they got the news first. And he got a hold of his younger brother, who was my co-pilot, and told him, you know, get Erwin prepared, get Erwin prepared. We're very concerned. We were standing at a roll call. Then they said, we want all the Jewish prisoners to remain, and nobody moved. Nobody moved. And then when they started it, our commanding officer, Colonel Zemke.
Hub Zemke, the great P-47 ace.
The great guy. And he was a great, great man. And he really and truly laid it out to the German commandant that you would better understand you're going to lose this war. And you do anything to my men, anything at all to my men, and you will become a war criminal, and I personally will come here and be sure that you are shot. I mean, he did it. He just told him. And we had another guy by the name of Colonel Spicer, who really made a tremendous speech, and he was sentenced to death for his speech. But, I mean, I have witnessed and I have lived and I've been in a camp with two of the bravest men I've ever known in my life. Mm. But they did it. They did. They segregated us. We were put in a barracks near the front gate. Every Jewish prisoner that they could find, they put in the same area. And I will tell you, from that moment on, I really and truly was concerned about whether I was going to get home. Up until then, I always felt, I really and truly believed that the Germans, we knew they were going to lose the war. We knew that when we started, but I had that feeling that I was going to get home. I was absolutely going to get home until I got segregated, and then I had questions, and then it was a mental battle then as to what was going to happen.
Now, did you hear at that point that Hitler had ordered all Jewish prisoners to be killed? Is that something?
That's what we were told.
Yep. I can imagine why it changed your perspective on things and made you worry.
And I must honestly tell you, it wasn't a comfortable environment because, you know, as Colonel Zemke said, these men are American officers. We know them as American officers, and they are recognized as American officers, and you are making a segregation of these men? We do not believe in that. That is not the way we do things. Well, I was part of an organization. My plane, there was 10 guys in my plane. Two of us were Jewish, and 8 of us weren't. But, we were all together, and anybody that knows and anybody that lived through flying in one of those planes, you were a team. You know, there was, in combat, you weren't lieutenant, you weren't sergeant, you were whatever your nickname is. My nickname was Russian because of my last name being Stovroff. And after we got shot down, I told everybody, for God's sake, don't call me by my nickname. I said, you know, they hate the Russians more than they hate us. And the beautiful part of the whole ending was I got liberated by the Russians.
Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my next question. And obviously there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of suffering, a lot of agony between that segregation and the couple months that were still to go before you were liberated.
Oh, yeah.
But what did that feel like when you realized they don't have time to kill us? Their time is up, we're free, and for us, the war is over.
Oh, it's something you really and truly, you know, you cannot live in the past, but you cannot forget it. Well, that's what we try to tell everybody, including governments, everybody, but you can't forget the past. And you can't forget the traumatic experience that all of us had, being captured and being put in and losing all your rights and relying on the enemy to feed you or take care of you, whatever it is. We all have post-traumatic stress disorder. Like today with these young men coming back, they are in the numbers of maybe 200,000 to 300,000 of them are going to have PTSD from going to 2 and 3 and 4 parts of combat. But, you know, being captured, being held, being the uncertainty and everything, you can't lose it. You can't let it get you, but you can't lose it. And I'm just very fortunate that I accepted what my problems are, and I have shared them as I do my claim work with the other POWs that I've worked with. My friend Ray Nasley and I work together in Palm Beach, and we have done over 400 claims of ex-POWs. So I've heard a lot of stories. Again, it makes me feel how lucky I am when I hear some of the other stories.
Well, I'm sure all those people that you've helped feel very blessed for your efforts on their behalf, as do the men and women coming back today and that are helped by Vets Helping Heroes. And again, vetshelpingheroes.org to read more about this. You can also link through that website to all kinds of information about Irwin's background and his history. There are a couple more questions that I want to ask you before we get back into some specifics of the vet dogs. Now, I've seen a picture of you shaking hands with another former POW of a different vintage, Senator John McCain, who had the privilege of giving you a Distinguished Flying Cross a few years late, 55 years late to be exact. Tell us how that developed and what that meant to you.
Well, actually what happened is, you know, you sort of drift apart from your crew after years and years, and then all of a sudden you get to the point where, hey, where are these guys that shared an experience in life that few people have? So I found out that we were having reunions, 44th Bomb Group, and I decided to start going to the reunions. And at the very first reunion, at one of the discussions we had, somebody said, what'd you do with your medals? And I said, I gave them to my grandson. And he said, well, why would you give your DFC to your grandson? And I said, why? I never got it. And fortunately, Colonel Gibson, our commanding officer at that point, was alive and there, and we talked to him, and he knew that our entire crew was given the DFC, and so one thing led to another, and I was advised that I was going to get the medal, and did I want to go to a camp, or John McCain was coming down at a certain date, and would be happy to give it to me. So that's how I got the medal from John McCain.
Well deserved, and I'm glad they took care of it eventually for you. It doesn't sound like you were complaining at all, but I'm sure it was still a special moment. Now, more recently, even, you've been given the French Legion of Honor. How did that come about?
Well, that came about because I was working in the VA hospital, and somebody came to me and said, the French government is looking for guys that were involved both on the ground and in the air that had anything to do with helping the freedom of France. And they said, didn't you bomb in France? And I said, yeah, I did. Out of my 35 missions, I think I had 7 or 8 of them were in France, somewhere in that area. And they said, well, they'd like to send you a form, and they'll analyze your form. And I said, well, that will be wonderful. So they sent me the form. And 2 years later, I was advised that the French consulate had said, we will be holding a ceremony, and it was a great honor to give you the highest medal that we have, which is the French Legion of Honor. And I have this beautiful medal at home, and it really is really special. And they also told me that please come to France and wear your medal because people will love you. Well, I don't know if I'm going to get to France, and I have yet to wear the medal, but I'm really proud of it. But not as proud of my American medals.
I know that you're not here to talk about all your medals or about what you did, that you're here to spread the word about your organization. But I just want to thank you for serving our country in World War II, for all the service you've provided to veterans since then. And I'm curious if you ever stop and think how things would be different if, A, they'd hit you when they were shooting at you as you parachuted out of that flaming B-17, or if your old neighbor from Buffalo hadn't been the guy to interrogate you in Frankfurt.
Yeah, there are so many things. I know I'm what a fortunate man I am, and I must tell you that doing what I'm doing now is so important, because being part of the American Vet Dog Veterans Canine Corps and being a fundraising arm for them, which we call Vets Helping Heroes, hard to describe how important this thing is, because I know how lucky I am, and I know when I see these young fellas how unfortunate it is for them that for the rest of their life they're going to be disabled one way or another, whether they're blind or whatever it is. And fortunately, we're part of a program that can deliver guide dogs, service dogs, combat stress relief dogs, military therapy dogs. We can cover everything that they need, and that's why I'm so pleased that I am part of it. The American Vet Dog Program is outstanding, and I'm privileged that I can raise the funds that they need so we can take care of these young men coming home.
You wouldn't still be doing this if you didn't really believe that it's making a big difference. I know you just mentioned some of the different areas that those dogs can be employed with the servicemen. Is there anything that people listening today, other than sending you a check in the mail, and they can do that online at the website, but anything other than that, that they can do to help this effort?
Well, if there are somebody out there listening to me and thinking, yes, there is something I would do, I'd like to do what you're doing, let me know. Or contact the American Vet Dog Program in Smithtown, New York. I'm sure that they would like to have more help, but contact me if you want to know who they are and who to talk to, and because we're the one organization that does put therapy dogs in Walter Reed for the veterans there to get acclimated to them, and what a therapy dog can do in calming him down in many cases.
I know that you've been bombarded with people wanting to hear from you or wanting to send you checks. I know that never gets old for you. But if there's one thing that's been shared with you by one of the veterans helped by one of these dogs that you like to share, is there one comment that just makes you feel, you know what, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing?
Yeah, I was in Washington, and we were having a graduation ceremony, and one of the veterans there has seizures. And while he was there, his dog started to bark. And these dogs do not bark. And it was telling him, sit down, you're going to have a seizure.
Wow.
And we saw it. And we saw how long it took. And then we saw the dog come over and lick his face and wake him up. And, you know, these are so unbelievable things to see what the dog can do. And this is just one example of it. And his name is Mike. And we talked to one another afterwards, and he gave me a big hug, and he said, you know what my dog means to me now. You've seen it. Now, what more can I tell you?
That's a life-saving dog.
Yeah.
That's why you're doing what you're doing. Well, that is perfect, Irwin. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I know your time is very valuable, and I hope that a lot of our listeners are going to be contacting you and supporting this program. And don't stop. I might call you down the road for an update.
Oh, and thank you. Thank you for calling on me.
And I did have that chance to catch up with Irwin this week. Vets Helping Heroes has now raised more than $7 million toward this effort, providing more than 225 dogs already with a commitment to reach 300. And he would love to have your help, too. VetsHelpingHeroes.org is the website. I have it linked for you at HometownHeroesRadio.com. And as I mentioned, there's now a book about his story, An Extraordinary Life Gone to the Dogs. Great title. I have that linked for you as well. And this is what I mean when I say we can be inspired by these members of our greatest generation, not only what they did then, but in Irwin's case, what continues to energize him now. I don't know about you, but it sure fires me up. We're out of time for now, but thanks for spending this hour with us on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.